Hello and welcome to The Front Page. Coming up on today's show, we will be telling you the extraordinary story of how the Racing Post exposed an illegal black market bookmaker operating quite openly in British racing. It's a story that lays bare the scale and reach of the black market and comes on the same day that MPs are set to debate affordability checks in Parliament following the petition calling for the unpopular checks to be scrapped. To discuss this story and all the other big news in the racing world this week, I'm delighted to be joined, first of all, by the Investigations author, Lee Morsed. Welcome, Lee.
Good morning.
By John Harding and by Maddie Pleil. Welcome, guys. We are going to dive straight in with our story of an illegal bookmaker operating openly in British racing. It's a story which is published in full in today's newspaper and on the Racing Post website, and we will of course link to those stories from the description. But to tell us more about the story is the author, Lee Morsed. So Lee, tell us first of all about how this bookmaker came to our attention.
So the Post bookmakers, a WhatsApp bookmaker, unlicensed bookmaker, unregulated bookmaker, have been putting their name about quite brazenly among racing folk. For some racing folk, their identity would not be a secret. They became increasingly well known, and they became known to the Racing Post. We saw a flyer advertisement for the Post, which outlined their services and also included the name of Hayden Simcock, who was listed as their commercial manager, with a telephone number for Mr. Simcock. And on seeing that, the obvious response from us was to call Mr. Simcock and find out about his service, although not at that point with the hat of a, ostensibly with the hat of a Racing Post journalist, but as a potential customer of the Post.
And we can listen to a clip of your conversation with Hayden Simcock, and that really sort of lays bare what they're offering. So let's listen to that now.
Obviously, whatever deposit you put in, we double for you. So I don't know what you were thinking of putting in, but let's just say you're putting in $2,000. We double it, so you've got $4,000 to bet with. You'll have $2,000 cash balance, £2,000 free bet balance. It's up to you how much you put in. Obviously, with Cheltenham coming up, if it was me, I'd be making best use of it and getting as much in as you can. Just so you've got funds ready for Cheltenham. We do get ridiculously busy through Cheltenham. Okay. So we are putting messages out shortly just to make sure that you've loaded up your accounts ready for Cheltenham. We're offering match deposits to all of our existing customers as well with the festival coming up. Just so we're not getting dragged down with people putting money in during the festival when we're really busy. We'd rather people load up, have money in your accounts, and then you're free to go and do whatever you want. Listen, we can afford to do it. That's why we do it. A lot of our customers at the moment are owners and trainers and racing managers within horse racing.
Okay.
Ultimately, because they're struggling, everyone's struggling to get on, and people don't want to provide bank statements, affordability checks.
Okay, Lee, there's a lot to unpack there, but let's start with the fact that this is just incredibly brazen. It's quite open. There's really nothing sort of seedy about it in some ways. They're just sort of talking through their offering with someone who's called them out of the blue.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you listen to a chunk of that and you would think they were a completely normal bookmaker in the way that they're talking about expecting to be ridiculously busy during the Cheltenham Festival. But there are elements that make it clear they're not a normal bookmaker, not least the match deposit offer. Yeah. I mean, you wonder how any bookmaker could afford to chuck in an extra $2,000 when a punter puts in £2,000.
And they're really pushing you to deposit as much as possible.
Yeah, which almost makes you think they might not be entirely trustworthy and also might not be paying levy, media rights or taxation.
Well, I think to clarify, they're certainly not.
Certainly not.
Exactly. And, some people sort of probably think, black market bookmakers are there to serve a need, because it's hard to get bet on with regulated bookmakers. But of course, that is the issue with them. Aside from the fact it's illegal to run one of these, it's also they are not contributing in any way to the sport of horse racing or beyond. And that sort of brings us on to one of the most striking things from that, and we certainly don't know the truth of this, but the claim that a lot of their customers are owners and trainers and racing managers. And we do know that the advertisements for this bookmaker have been circulating widely within the sport over recent months. That's quite an extraordinary thing for them to claim.
It is, but it sort of, it does fit with the way these WhatsApp bookmakers work. We did a big piece in the Post in the middle of last week on the black market in general and its links to horse racing. And obviously, we hear plenty about the offshore unlicensed firms, but WhatsApp firms have increasingly become a big part of the market. And very often, these WhatsApp firms, they work with established racing figures, figures that are known to other people in racing often, and these are used almost as old-fashioned commission agents, people who potential customers might trust and might bring them into the business. And the extension of that then is what with this firm in particular, what Mr. Simcock is alleging is that many of his customers are owners, trainers and racing managers. He references the reasons that would be pushing a lot of people away from the regulated market, namely affordability checks and also account restrictions. And he goes on to outline that he himself is part of the racing community.
Yeah, so he used to own horses and ran a syndicate.
Yeah, so he is, Hayden Simcock is a BHA registered owner. He's had five horses. Four ran under the banner of Dark Horse Partnership, which had five winners over the last few years. He's had one runner in his own name as well. He says in the conversation that he is a syndicate manager. So he is absolutely someone who paints himself, quite rightly actually, as someone who is within horse racing.
And the incredible fact of that is that this is someone who's operating what is in effect an illegal business.
Yep.
And they're doing so openly, under their own name, handing out phone numbers, making no attempt to provide any sort of alias or cover. What does that tell us about how the black market's developing?
I think it tells us that it's developing with a worrying degree of confidence. It doesn't believe, the people doing this clearly don't believe that they are in any great danger. They believe that there is a market, an appetite for the product that they are offering. And we know that to be the case from anecdotal evidence, from the numbers that the people are moving away from the regulated market. We know that they believe there is a market for it. But we also know, as I say, that they are not fearful of being caught. They don't believe that the industry regulator, the Gambling Commission, is actively chasing them down. Now, the Gambling Commission, in the piece that we ran during the week on the wider black market, they did point to a number of they referenced data that would suggest that they are going after people and they are making a difference and they are catching people and they are stopping people and they're taking action. But the evidence of Hayden Simcock and his operation, and no doubt many others, would suggest that this is a confident illegal industry that does not think it is vulnerable at the moment to the regulator or wider authorities.
You later called up Hayden Simcock again, this time as a Racing Post reporter to confirm his identity, using another phone number that was associated with the syndicate activity, and also to confront him on his involvement with an illegal bookmaker. Tell us about the tenor of that conversation.
Well, again, just before I talk about the tenor of it, the fact that it was easy to get Hayden Simcock's other telephone number, the telephone number that is listed on the Dark Horse Partnership Facebook page, again, underlines how brazen and confident this has all been. The tenor of that conversation was, initially, I tried to ease him into the conversation by talking about the the Dark Horse partnership and just asking about its current status, and then going to ask him about the link between that and the post. And at no point did he try to pretend that he wasn't aware of the post. He said that he was a friend of the owner, a gentleman called David, and he tried to imply that he didn't actually work for the Post. He just, in effect, helps out now and again, which was clearly very different from the conversation that we'd had, a 12-minute conversation a few days earlier, in which he'd made clear he was the commercial manager and he outlined the nature of the business. He said in that conversation that he would ask David, the owner of the business, to make contact with me and give me a call. No such call has been received.
John, the significance of this story today, of all days, is that the parliamentary debate on affordability checks is going to take place. Just tell us a bit about the link between affordability checks and the black market.
Yeah, so it's sort of been a conversation that's run alongside affordability checks, and I think the government and at times the Gambling Commission have perhaps been a little bit, not flippant, but have not quite recognised the scale of the black market and the threat that it actually poses, and would perhaps have taken the position that, well, racing and bookmakers, you would say that. You would come up with this convenient place where customers will go if we overregulate the market, or, you know, we add regulation to the market that you operate in. But I think what this has done is just laid bare the fact that this is a very genuine and real threat, and that if you do push customers too far, if you do overregulate a market and almost give them no choice but to go elsewhere, then there is an elsewhere. This does exist, and it's one that offers absolutely nothing to the Exchequer nor to British Racing.
And you were in the Culture Secretary Lucy Fraser's constituency last week, speaking to some of her constituents, particularly those involved in the racing industry. It obviously borders Newmarket. Tell us a little bit about what you heard on the ground there.
Yeah, it was really interesting, Tom, because you know, we've all read the news stories and the reports and the projections, and you get a flavour of the, you know, the financial damage of up to 50 million a year if they're brought in their proposed form. But actually being on the ground, you sense the potential human cost of this, which I think is really important. They were obviously, the people I spoke to at various studs and training yards, they were concerned about the financial damage and naturally the knock-on effect for prize money, among other things. But more than that, it was a case of, look, here are people who have dedicated their lives to this. It's not a job like other jobs. It's something that they are passionate about, they are dedicated to, and they're afraid, really, about what something that is completely outside of their control might mean for the future of the industry.
And Maddie, we heard about this from a very significant press statement from the BHA this last week, when they warned that if affordability checks in their current model are brought in, 1 in 7, up to 1,000 stable staff could lose their jobs as a consequence.
Yeah, Jonathan mentioned the 50 million a year, and we know that racing's workforce is in a pretty precarious spot at the moment, regardless of the impact of affordability checks. And sometimes I don't think the correlation between these threats to our industry and what that can actually do on a ground level. Jonathan was mentioning in Newmarket, he spoke to lots of people in studs and on the ground, and people who were keen to keep the thoroughbred at the heart of the debate. And, you know, without a workforce, we don't have a sport, we don't have an industry. And the prospect of losing, as you say, 1 in 7, between 600 and 1,000 stable staff alone via this ripple effect is incredibly alarming.
And it sort of precipitated, I think, this statement from John Gosden, which we carried in Saturday's Racing Post. And John Gosden, of course, popularly sort of regarded as almost a statesman of British racing. I don't think I've ever heard John Gosden or seen John Gosden write something that's so obviously underpinned by a deep, deep anger.
Yeah, of course. He's been engaged in this conversation for some time now, obviously is a senior figure, incredibly well-respected figure in Newmarket and across the world in terms of horse racing. That's another thing that was mentioned in Lucy Fraser's constituency, of course. British racing having to compete globally and how these new checks may ultimately threaten that when it comes to prize money, etc. But yeah, he was incredibly passionate, enthusiastic, and strongly against the implementation of these checks in their current form, you know, making links to prohibition and saying that that didn't stop people, you know, drinking alcohol, etc. And that, you know, this was an example of how the government's being let down again in another one of its key industries.
And Lee, we also saw in today's paper, I'd spoken to the former Chancellor, Nadhem Zahawi, and he described affordability checks proposals as ill-advised, blunt and damaging, and called on the government to reverse course. All of which brings us back to the fact of this debate tonight, prompted by 100,000 signatures. There's clearly a groundswell of commentary and stories which indicate why affordability checks are damaging. However, do we expect anything to be the product of this debate?
I don't think it's going to be a case of a magic wand being waved and then from Tuesday morning everything is suddenly better. But it does provide a valuable opportunity for parliamentarians, for representatives, our representatives, to talk about this subject in Westminster. The affordability checks isn't something that is going to pass through Parliament in the way a normal bill will. There's not going to be a debate on the floor of the House about it in the way that you might get with other other legislation, that there doesn't have to be a vote that determines whether MPs say yes or no to affordability checks. The government, in effect, can enact this whenever it wants. Once it believes that there is a frictionless system, then they can press go on it. So I think what this does, though, is it provides an opportunity for MPs to express a point of view on this, mindful of where public opinion seems to be on the subject. It gives them a chance, I think, to hammer home both the pragmatic arguments against affordability checks, and we've outlined those, not least the financial damage that affordability checks are doing to horse racing, and the fact that we don't believe that they will succeed in what is ostensibly their aim, namely to help those with gambling issues, because as we know, as we've seen in this piece today, the black market is there ready to grab them. I think it's a chance to look at the pragmatic issue, but also the principle issue, because there is a massive principle at stake here, namely that it seems completely wrong that the state can determine how any of us spend our own hard-earned money. You know, that we're not being told how many bottles of wine we can get from the off-licence, yet we are being told how much money the state believes that we can spend on betting. And until the state determines that betting is an illegal activity, there seems to be a massive contradiction in that. So hopefully this debate gives us a chance to hear pragmatic and principled reasons why affordability checks is the wrong way to go, and hopefully the government listens to the people in the debate tonight and people like Nadhem Zahawi, respected parliamentarians, who are mounting strong objections.
Thank you, Lee. So that is the affordability checks latest. We, of course, will have full coverage of the debate on our website and in the newspaper. Do stay tuned for all of that. But we're now going to move on to other events happening in the racing world, and there have been plenty, because we are fast closing in on the spring festivals. The Cheltenham Festival is practically around the corner, but the Grand National is not far away either, and we had the weights last week. John, I don't think there's any surprises there. The big story was the dominance of the Irish Raiders and potentially just how much of that reduced 34-runner field they might represent.
Yeah, well, it's likely to be the overwhelming majority. That was certainly the view of the handicapper. I think it was sort of six or seven best-case scenario British-trained runners.
Six or seven?
With the sort of guaranteed runners there in the weights. So yeah, it is. It's just a very difficult situation. I think the Grand Nationals, as it stands with those weights, is almost geared towards the kind of class horses rather than the form horses. Mm. I think that's an argument that's been put forward a few times. And the fact of the matter is, most of the class horses are in Ireland. If you look at the top ones in the market, all Irish trained, all Irish trained. Hewick, it would be interesting if Hewick comes out and puts the cat amongst the pigeons in terms of the weight, but generally speaking, the makeup of the race is such that it could be run in Ireland.
And Maddie, what did we learn other than the incredible dominance of Ireland?
Well, we learned that we have a new favourite in some places, which was, of course, Vanillier. He's been very favourably treated, seemingly, by the handicapper on his defeat, running on defeat to Corrack Rambler last year. Lots of people, fans of Corrack Rambler, think he can double up as well off his weight. But and then, of course, we had Vanillier run in the Bobby Joe Chase yesterday, which was won by Iron Maximus, which caused another market move for him. So it's been all action in the Grand National betting this week. And a couple of horses not qualifying, but no massive shocks. Just the one horse actually scratched from the race. So still all to play for and very open at this stage.
And one of the other things that we looked at last week was Chris Cook pointed out that those who were involved in the disturbances before last year's Grand National haven't actually faced any sort of legal consequences for that, and worrying therefore that this would sort of embolden a repeat come April.
Yeah, I think naturally when you're talking about the Grand National, you're talking about racing's showcase event. It's the one day of the year, more so than any other, when the public's eyes are on Aintree and are on our sport. So naturally that's going to be a hotbed for action and potential protesters. We saw how in the summer during the Derby, that wasn't the case then. You know, there were police repercussions and things did escalate, although not successfully for them. So yeah, I think it's definitely something to be mindful of in the build-up to the race, and I'm sure that all the respective parties will be doing all they can to protect the event.
And John, you were up in Liverpool for the weights, hanging out, hobnobbing, I think is the correct term, with Liverpool royalty.
I think that's fair, yeah. I met King Kenny Dalglish, which was a little bit surreal. A little anecdote for you, I was chatting to him about Arsenal beating Liverpool this season, which was great, while John Barnes came over and took a bite of King Kenny's dessert accidentally, while Ian Rush was laughing it up on the other side of the table, and it felt a bit like a fever dream.
It sounds a bit like a fever dream, absolutely. It's incredible that they get that sort of person to come along to what is basically a quite a technical event in some respects. Yeah. Really does talk about where the Grand National sits and the Liverpool's.
It's really important. Really important. And look, whether Kenny Dalglish was there to find out whether Marla Mission was on a workable mark, I don't know. I doubt it. But he was there. And actually, the patronage of those Liverpool legends and a few other famous faces is, you know, it can be something that you can understate, but I think it is important actually that they're there, that they're engaged with it. It is a race that has a relationship to its city in a way very few others do, even globally. So it was a good event.
And any early national fancies taken your eye?
Well, I've slightly nodded to it there. I quite like Marla Mission. I realise he's got to overcome a few trends because he's been in the cupboard this year so far, but I think he's got a decent mark and they've protected that mark, so he's of interest to me.
How about you, Maddie?
Well, the big buzz horse, wasn't it, was Meeting of the Waters for Paul Byrne and Willie Mullins, but I'm actually interested in the duo's other horse, Mr. Incredible, who was still going quite well when the saddle slipped at the Canal Turn second time round last year. Very quirky horse, but he's got good staying chase handicap form in races like the Classic Chase and the Kim Muir. Haven't seen him since, so I want a bit of assurance that he's still out and about and going for the race, but I'd be definitely interested in him at around 33-1. He's on my radar for sure.
And Lee, if you were going to use your legal bookmaker free bets, where would they go?
Oh, I'm flattered that you asked me. So I do like Meeting of the Waters as well. I was a big Corrack Rambler man last year. I backed him for the Gold Cup. I could see him getting placed in that and going on to the National. But Kitty's Light is interesting. Was rampant in those big spring staying chases last year, winning the Scottish National and the Bet365 Gold Cup. Hasn't been in great form so far this season, nor has the Christian Williams string in general terms. But Kitty's Light is a spring horse and could easily bounce back in the Ultima with a big run there before going on to the National. And just one thing I would say about this year's National is I do wonder if how the race looks will have a big say in determining how it's shaped in the future. The 27.7 thing, if we get something like that, the BHA has said that it wouldn't impose a trainer limit this year, but it would keep the subject under review. Mm-hmm. I think the Grand National was what it wanted to review. I think that will be interesting. And I thought Ruby Walsh at the event as well on Tuesday, some of his comments regarding he believes the race needs to be changed and that the final field needs to more closely reflect the best 34 horses in mid-April, not mid-February. That's the point I was making in the column a few weeks ago when I said that penalties should be introduced for the Grand National. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if by the time we get to next year's Grand National, the race is just slightly different to the one that we get this year.
Well, isn't that always the case with the Grand National?
Isn't it always? It's an evolving beast.
An evolving race, isn't it? And just to finish, guys, we have to turn to Cheltenham. We can't not talk about Cheltenham when it's barely a fortnight away. I think it's fair to say that, as is probably often the case, this build-up to Cheltenham has had its fair share of navel-gazing alongside the sort of feverish antipost discussions. There's always a sort of, you know, is Cheltenham too big? Is something wrong with Cheltenham? Is it going the wrong way?
Soul searching.
And David Jennings, Mr. Cheltenham, wrote a great column on Saturday, sort of talking about why I love Cheltenham. He compared it to his wife. He said, I love my wife, but she can always improve you, which is very risky for in the Jennings household. But we haven't heard anything from him since, actually, so I'm not sure how it went down. No. But it did get me thinking, you know, Cheltenham is fantastic, but what would improve Cheltenham? If you could do one thing that would improve Cheltenham, what would it be, Lee?
I would chop out some of the races led on the Turner's Novices Chase. I think a mid-distance Grade 1 Championship Novice Chase is wrong. I think there are just too many championship races. A championship should be a race in which the best horses take each other on. If you give the best horses too many opportunities at one meeting to take each other on, then it inevitably dilutes competition. So I would go back to the old days. We had an Arkle and you had a Broadway Novices Chase, but not one in between. You could extend that to some other races too.
Cut back the Cheltenham Festival to fewer races. Crew. John, what would it be? You can't have the same thing. You've got to come up with something new.
Oh, great.
I think this idea of actually having to nominate the race, particularly with the novices that those horses are going for within a certain window, I think that would add a lot more certainty to the markets, a lot more interest in the markets. It's something that you could make a big play of actually 3 weeks out, right?
It'd be a big day, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It would be a big day.
You know, it's almost like a deadline day where Willie Mullins has to say, right, this one's going here, this one's going there. I think it would just be another thing for us to sell, but also add a huge amount of certainty for punters.
And you can imagine the antipost market's going crazy mad after that.
Yeah. There is a sort of precedent for that too. If you look at the Breeders' Cup, around a week and a half out, then when you get the nominations, trainers have to say first preference, second preference. And I don't think there is a regulation aspect to it in terms of they change their mind. So it could be a bit wishy-washy. But at least there, they have to say first preference, second preference, because the Breeders' Cup know that they're trying to sell an event and people want to have some idea about what the likely field is going to be.
It feels like a bit of a no-brainer. Maddie, what's your suggestion?
Worth saying just before I do, Factor File, we now know he's going to go for the Brown Advisory. So that was interesting that given Willie Mullins wasn't compelled to come forward and say something and clarify his target, he did, which is, I wonder why. Why at this point would you choose to clarify? Because you can always go back on what you've said. I'm being given the short straw here because I'm going last. I'm not exactly sure how I would do it, but I would definitely look into reviewing the enclosure structure at Cheltenham. I'm not a big fan of, you know, only certain people being allowed in certain areas. Mm. I want it to be affordable, and I think there's definitely a space for the best mate enclosure, for instance, being more accessible and a lot more affordable. But at the same time, I don't find it particularly comfortable when you're walking around racecourse and you're constantly being asked if you have the right badges or accreditation. Or I think open it up, try and give as many people as you can the best experience, the best access as you can.
Yeah, definitely. I think that is quite off-putting. I agree with you. I'll go lob in one as well, which sounded good before you guys came out with your very erudite suggestions. My big pet peeve with Cheltenham is the size of the big screens. Which I just think when you're at Cheltenham and you're watching a race on those big screens, you basically can't really see what's happening unless you're basically stood at the nearest point to them. You go to lots of other race courses, lots of other events, they have far, far bigger screens. So get bigger screens. Catterick has the biggest screen at a British race course. Little fact
here
there. Catterick has the biggest screen. I mean, well done, Catterick.
How do you know that?
It was in the Racing Post.
Was it? Was it really?
It was in the Racing Post. Recently, Catterick acquired the biggest big screen of it, on for any British race course.
Really?
It was a forward-thinking move by Catterick.
Yeah.
Full marks to them. Jeez. Take note, Cheltenham. That's all we've got time for this week. But many, many thanks to my panellists, Lee Morrishead, John Harding and Maddie Playo. And thanks very much to you as well for joining us for this edition of The Front Page. We will be back again next week with all the big stories in racing. Until then, goodbye.